Greetings, I'm Austin Egbert, director and editor for Mind Matters News. Welcome to another binge cast, where multiple episodes have been combined into a single broadcast. Today's binge cast features Gary Smith, author of The AI Delusion, who discusses some of the problems facing machine learning and big data, such as the Texas sharpshooter fallacies and the inherent inability of computers to understand the data, leading to poor decisions made based on coincidental correlations. Enjoy!
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marx.
Greetings. Groucho Marx famously quipped, "I once shot an elephant in my pajamas." He then went on to say how he got in my pajamas, I'll never know. The statement, "I once shot an elephant in my pajamas," is ambiguous. It's a pun which needs explanation or some sort of context. Without clarifying context, the computer will be confused by phrases with double meaning. The simple pun is an example. The need for clarification includes queries to IBM Watson. Now, IBM Watson, if you remember, won against the world's best Jeopardy players a couple of decades ago. But Watson has recently been called a joke. What's going on? To what degree did Watson's inability to understand contribute to its decline? To talk with me today on Mind Matters is Gary N. Smith, and we're delighted to have him because he's really an accomplished and very credentialed intellectual. Gary is the Fletcher Jones Professor of Economics at Pomona College. He received his PhD in economics from Yale University, and after receiving his PhD, he served as an assistant professor there for 7 years. He has written a number of books, and the titles themselves are very intriguing. One is Standard Deviations, Flawed Assumptions, Tortured Data, and Other Ways to Lie with Statistics. He also wrote another book, Money Machine. I have to get this. Gary, I've not read this book, but this I need some background in. The Surprisingly Simple Power of Value Investing. His research has been featured on a number of top venues like Bloomberg Radio Network, CNBC, The Brian Lehrer Show, Forbes, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Motley Fool, Newsweek, and Business Week. Gary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Your most recent book, I got to say, I listened to it. I didn't read it. I listened to it. And then I bought a hard copy so I could get quotes and stuff out of it. But it's a book entitled The AI Delusion. It's published by Oxford University Press. And it's a wonderfully written book. And I would recommend anybody that wants to find out more about some of the things that you don't hear on the headlines about artificial intelligence. Dr. Smith is a practitioner that knows data. He spent his career in data. He knows how data can fool you and how it can inform you. And he says humans must always be in the loop in interpretation and of conclusions from computers. Gary, what motivated you to write the book, The AI Delusion?
Well, I'm an economist, and I've long been fascinated with data and the stock market and statistics. And One of the amazing things, one of the things that's always amazed me is how easy it is to find a coincidental correlation and to think it's meaningful. And so investors do this all the time. They find some pattern. They think it's the way to beat the stock market. And then it turns out to be fool's gold. One of the most famous ones you probably know is the Super Bowl stock market indicator. That if a team in the NFC wins the Super Bowl or a team in the AFC that used to be in the NFL wins the Super Bowl, that's supposed to be good for the stock market. And then if a team in the AFL wins, the AFC wins the Super Bowl, that's bad for the stock market. And it's utter nonsense. And the ironic thing about it is the guy who created it, Leonard Coppett, he intended it to be a joke. He wanted to show people that correlation is not causation. And he was absolutely flabbergasted when people start taking it seriously. And people still do. And I have friends on Wall Street who they're rooting for the Rams because they think that's going to be good for the stock market. And it's just nuts, but it's part of human nature to see patterns and think they're meaningful. And what we have with computers nowadays, and AI in particular, is just that kind of data mining, coincidental correlations on steroids, because computers are so good at finding patterns and correlations. but absolutely useless at deciding whether they make sense or not, or there's some kind of cosmic joke.
I dealt with a financial guy. Now, there's two types of people that do trading. There's the ones, I think, do they call them quants that do the regression lines and they look for statistics?
Yep, the algo traders and the quants are going all by data. Yeah,
exactly. And then there's the people who do analysis. And I even know in my field, like Claude Shannon, who was a great nerd in terms of mathematician, says, no, none of this quant stuff works. He actually went through kind of a Warren Buffett quality sort of assessment. I had this friend tell me that nobody uses quants anymore, especially in academia. I mean, they're used, but people in academia don't take them seriously at all.
Well, that's true, but at Wall Street, they do. It's been estimated that a third of all trades now are algo trades made by computers with no human supervision.
Well, let me tell you something that he said and get your reaction to it. He said he used to trade futures. I forget what type of futures it was, but he traded futures, and he said he used quants, trend lines and stochastics. And he said that, it kind of worked. And I said, well, wait a minute. You just said that quants didn't work. And his response was, yeah, but everybody else uses quants that trades these futures. And because of that, if I can get just a little bit heads up on that, I can beat them to the markets. So it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy is what he said.
It's also true on these computers that a lot of the successful computer trading is just simply front running, where they learn of an order that comes in and they buy before the order is executed, then they sell to the order and they make a penny or a tenth of a penny or a hundredth of a penny a share. And they get it just for excessively cheating, just for ripping somebody off.
And I guess that's legal, right?
It's right now it is.
Oh, geez. Okay. Getting back to the topic, trusting AI without examination is dangerous. You start out your book with, I think, just an interesting background in Barack Obama's use of data analytics in his campaign and how successful it was. And then Hillary Clinton came along and used the data analytics, and it didn't work too well. What happened then? What's the deal?
Well, Barack Obama was this little-known senator with an unhelpful name. And he had the guts to run against Hillary Clinton back in 2008. And he had charm and charisma, and he was fresh, a fresh face. But he also had all these computer nerds working for him. And they did this micro-targeting where they went out and they tried to, for every single potential voter in the country, they tried to figure out what kind of issues appealed to that voter. And if the person was likely to vote for Obama, how to get that person to the polls and get him to vote. And it worked, and he was able to raise unheard of amounts of money, and he was able to defeat Hillary Clinton and then John McCain. And so that sort of sealed the deal on micro-targeting using computers being a effective political tool. And so when Hillary ran again in 2016, she tried to do the same thing. And she even hired some of Obama's people to work for her, and they created this huge software program they called Ada, after some long-ago mathematician. And they went out and micro-targeted, and they did the same thing he did, except some of the stuff that made a difference they couldn't put in the computer, like the enthusiasm factor. And so when Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump gave speeches, tens of thousands of people showed up and yelled and screamed. They were excited. And when Hillary Clinton gave a speech, a couple hundred people would show up and sit politely. And you couldn't put that in a computer. And so Ada, the computer algorithm, had no idea that she was in trouble because her data showed that the Democrats always win Wisconsin and Michigan and Minnesota, and so you don't need to campaign there, you don't need advertisements. And meanwhile, the people on the ground were saying, people here are not excited about you. You got to spend some money, you got to spend some resources, and stop wasting money in Arizona and go back to the states that really count for winning this election. And in terms of message, too, the computer was telling her the most effective message is, hey, I'm not perfect, but at least Donald Trump's worse. And her husband, Bill Clinton, one of the greatest campaigners we've ever seen, he beat Bush famously with a slogan, it's the economy, stupid.
Yes.
And he kept saying, what people care about is jobs. And they're worried about losing their jobs. They've already lost their jobs. And that's why Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are getting votes. And the computer couldn't handle that because the computer didn't, you couldn't enter stuff like that into a computer. You couldn't put in enthusiasm and fears, and worries and things like that. And of course she lost. And afterwards, you know, some experienced people, Democrats, said it was like political malpractice the way she used her computer.
My goodness. So that is an example of somebody looking at the data from a computer and not giving it the context that they needed, just like a pun.
Some people say, you know, if you can't measure it, it doesn't count. And sometimes the things that count can't be measured.
That's true. Yeah. That's actually one of the things that I'm involved in was the inability of computers to do things like become enthusiastic, become creative. And because of that lack of ability, many times it doesn't come out unless it's actually programmed in. Actually, I was in neural networks back in the 90s and when Bill Clinton was running, and they hired this guy to do neural networks. And what they wanted to do is use neural networks to figure out what the swing group would be in the election.
Right.
And this guy trained the neural network and he found out it was married families that went bowling. That was the swing vote. That was in a column by Robert Novak. I don't know if you remember Robert Novak, It's just kind of crazy. Well, let's talk about IBM Watson.
Sure.
That beat the world champion at Jeopardy. I learned from your book, this was the first time that the contest, it was kind of gamed in a way, in the sense that the programmers of Watson had certain types of questions that they did not want Watson to be asked. And it was gamed. Tell us about that. That is just fascinating.
Yeah, there's two kinds of gaming going on. One was that for the human contestants, they weren't allowed to buzz in until a light went on. And it took them a fraction of a second to see the light and respond. And Watson was sent, it couldn't see lights, so it was sent an electronic signal when it was okay to buzz in. And that signal got there faster and was processed faster. And so Watson was able to buzz in repeatedly faster than the humans were. And it wasn't that the humans didn't know the answer, just they didn't have the reflexes. The other gaming was that computers don't really understand words. So you say a word like Abraham Lincoln, or no, say 16th president of the United States, and the computer doesn't know what 16th and president of the United States means, but it can go rummage through its Wikipedia-like sources and find those words and match them to a president, Abraham Lincoln, and come back with who was Abraham Lincoln. But then you put anything in that's like a pun or a joke or a riddle or sarcasm that you can't look up in Wikipedia, and the computers are helpless. For example, in the first round, one of the final Jeopardy clues was, its largest airport is named for a World War II hero. Its second largest for a World War II battle. And so the correct answer was Chicago. And Watson guessed Toronto. And apparently because it was confused in the second part of that sentence, what it referred to. And that is a common problem with computers. There's even a thing called the Winograd Schema Challenge. Winograd. He's a computer scientist at Stanford. And he thought up this test of computer knowledge. And so the question is, what does it refer to in this sentence? I can't chop down that tree with this axe because it is too small. Does it refer to the tree or the axe? And humans, we immediately know what it is, right? Because we know what a tree is. We know what an axe is. We know what chop down means. We know that small axes are not going to bring down big trees. But computers can't answer that question because they don't know what it refers to. And there's a semi-annual Winograd Schema Challenge where computers try and get 90% of the questions right. And right now they get about 50% right. They do no better than guessing because they truly don't understand what words mean. And so in the Jeopardy thing, the IBM people did not want any kind of questions where there was ambiguity about what was being asked. Because ambiguity is very hard for computers to deal with.
I have a lower class example from the Flintstones. Fred got his fingers glued in a bowling ball, and Barney got a big hammer. And Fred said, "When I nod my head, hit it." So
I know.
So there we have also a vague pronoun that. By the way, Barney did whack Fred in the head. So if that's a spoiler alert for everybody. So one of the things you mentioned, I think everybody is familiar with the IBM Watson commercial,
right,
with Bob Dylan, yeah, a great songwriting icon, Nobel Prize winner, who came out and Bob Dylan came out and Watson said, I read 50 billion pages a second or whatever it is. And then he says, I've read all your work and I think that your primary objective is to promote the idea that time passes and love fades. And that was Watson's summary of Dylan's work. You pointed out that was actually pretty shallow.
It was really bad. A friend of mine who's a pioneer in artificial research, Roger Shank, he wrote a blog about this, and he said, the ad made me laugh, or would have if it had not made me so angry. I will say it clearly, Watson is a fraud. And you and I, people who know Bob Dylan, what he was writing about was the Vietnam War and civil rights. But he didn't use those words. And so Watson couldn't figure out what he was actually writing about. And so one of the examples I use, it's Roger Shank, is the opening lines to The Times They Are A-Changing. Come gather round people wherever you roam. Admit that the waters around you have grown and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And what does that mean? And you and I, we can argue about it, disagree about it, like any great poem or literature. But we have a basic idea about what he's saying, that there's trouble brewing and things, the times are changing. And Watson has no idea. It doesn't know what any of those individual words mean. Or you put them together, it has no idea what those words mean. And so it comes up with silly things like he's writing about time passes and love fades, but not at all what he was writing about.
So basically, IBM Watson doesn't understand. It doesn't have the ability to understand anything which is metaphorical, which has double meaning, which is meant in whimsy. And it kind of takes everything literally then, right?
Yes, but even deeper than that, it truly does not understand what words mean. And so, like, its inability to understand what it refers to in a sentence is because it does not actually know what any of the words in the sentence means. It can count them. It can look up definitions. It can find rhyming. Well, it can't find rhyming words. It can spell check them, but it doesn't actually know what it means. It's like there's this guy, Nigel Richards, who has won the French Scrabble Championship twice. And he doesn't understand any of the words that he uses, that he spells, but it's just a big mathematical puzzle. And that's what computers do with words. They spell check them, they check up, look up definitions and stuff like that, but they literally do not know what they mean. And you'll see that in some translation programs, like even the best deep neural network ones, the Google Translate ones, sometimes the stuff that comes back is just absolute gibberish because they really didn't, the way they translate sentences is word by word. Well, first sentence by sentence, and then word by word within a sentence without having any concept of what the person is trying to say. And so they'll come back with translations which kind of match up sentence for sentence and word for word, but lose all meaning because they don't know meaning.
Exactly. We've been talking about IBM Watson, and we've talked about a bunch of interesting stuff. The big thing is that IBM Watson doesn't understand. I've heard it say, for example, that you can add numbers with computers, but computers themselves don't understand numbers.
Exactly.
It's actually deeper than that. And you talked about Searle's Chinese Room, which I think is a great story that explains the inability of computers to understand. Could you talk about that a little?
Well, it was John Searle, a philosopher, and he proposed this experiment that suppose you had a computer in a closed room and you give it instructions in Chinese and it processes those instructions and sends it back some output in Chinese. And it does a really good job at it. And the person outside the room thinks that there's a Chinese person inside the room. Now imagine a human's inside that room. And a human doesn't understand Chinese either, doesn't read or write, but has exactly the code, knows the code that's inside the computer. And so the Chinese instructions come under the door. The human picks it up, has no idea what it means, but uses the computer code to formulate some kind of answer and slips it back outside the door in Chinese characters. And it is exactly the same as a computer, except the human doesn't understand Chinese at all and is able to do it. And isn't that the same way with the computer? The computers can do things without really having any understanding of what they're doing. And that's the core of the issue, is the computers, they don't understand words, they don't understand numbers and context, they don't have common sense or wisdom or critical thinking. They follow instructions flawlessly, but that's not the same as understanding things or being able to interpret things or think about things critically. There's a great example, which is this little question. Is it safe to walk downstairs backwards if I close my eyes? And of course, humans have common sense and wisdom, and we say no. And a computer can't answer that question because it literally does not know what walk downstairs backwards, close eyes, what safe, doesn't know what any of those things really mean in a human sense, because it doesn't understand the world. It just does mathematical representations of letters and numbers and other inputs it gets, and looks for patterns and correlations and gives some sort of output based on the instructions it's been given, without having any true understanding of what is going on in the real world.
Okay. Do you believe this statement, that IBM Watson is kind of like an illustration of John Searle's Chinese Room, except they're using all of Wikipedia and all of the internet in order to garner the answers?
Yeah, exactly.
And So IBM Watson is a big example of Searle's Chinese Room.
Yep.
And that's about all that it's doing. It doesn't understand what it's doing. It simply follows the algorithms. Since we're talking about IBM Watson, do you know the current status of IBM Watson? I've heard some bad things.
Well, they've been trying to go into all sorts of things and with mixed success. And one of the most hopeful things was that they'd be able to revolutionize medical care and healthcare. And it's not worked, because they could look up symptoms of various diseases, and they could look up cures for various diseases, and they could look up medical articles, but they don't understand which are more meaningful than others. They don't understand which medical articles are reasonable and which are bull. And so a lot of doctors have become disillusioned with Watson. And a lot of hospitals have literally pulled the plug. And just last year, the IBM Health Initiative, they laid off a bunch of people because of this disillusionment.
Yeah, I was really excited about IBM Watson being able to help with cancer. I know in my field, probably your field also, that there are hundreds of papers published daily in our discipline, and there's no way we can keep up with them.
And there's no way to tell which ones are real and which ones are just BS.
Exactly, and that's a topic that I want to talk to you about also, is the fake papers that are being generated from inappropriate data. But I was really excited about this because I thought, you know, these physicians, they have a cancer patient with certain number of symptoms, and they can go to this IBM Watson, they can read them the symptoms and try to let Watson understand. Of course, Watson doesn't understand, but try to tell Watson what these symptoms are. And Watson digs through all these hundreds of papers that are published every day, which are thousands per month and tens and hundreds of thousands over the last decade, and actually grabs the latest results and brings it to the physicians and says, try this. But like you said, even if it was able to do that, there's no way to test the viability and the validity of the results that Watson gives. Yeah. So I understand that, as you do, that IBM Watson is kind of going toes up. I read that MD Anderson Cancer Center, the project fails and it shut down. It's looking for other vendors right yeah. now. So that's kind of sad. I don't know if you follow this much, but is the failure due to strictly IBM Watson's inability to understand, or is it due to business practices? I've heard both. I don't know what the status of the failure is.
I don't know how much to weigh them, but I'm pretty confident that a lot of it's due to the fact that the computers don't understand what sense to make of such things and how to sort through sense and nonsense.
Now, I've talked to other people and they say, hey, it's like Googling. When you want to Google something, you have to be very specific with the keywords that you enter. Maybe these doctors and physicians just don't know the right keywords to enter. What would be your reaction to that?
I don't think that's it. I think that the problem goes much, much deeper. And in the sense of, again, like I've been saying, that although computers could come back with output, they don't know which output is relevant, which is irrelevant.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I've also heard that they've mismanaged it also. It's the idea. I know as an engineer, you think that you get a good result and the world's going to beat a path to your door to use your invention. And boy, that doesn't work. You need to interface and you need to get down and dirty with the people that are actually applying it. You mentioned that you had read, or one of your colleagues said that IBM Watson was a fraud. Yeah. I got a quote from venture capitalist, and I have practiced saying his name, Chamath Palihapitiya. Pretty good, huh? Chamath.
I'll let you wrestle that one.
Chamath Palihapitiya. He is the CEO of the investment firm Social Capital, and he pulled no punches. He said, Watson is a joke, just to be honest. And then he said, using very nice words, that IBM Watson appeals to stupid people. Here's what he said. He said, I think that IBM is excellent at using their sales and marketing infrastructure to convince people who have asymmetrically less knowledge to pay for something. Yeah. I think somebody with asymmetrically less knowledge is somebody that's stupid, right? So he said it so nicely, though.
In 2017, AI was the marketing word of the year, and all these companies are just, they're saying we do AI because it sounds so cool and sexy, and it's often just a marketing gimmick.
Now, you said it was the marketing word of
the year. The American Association of Marketers or something chose it as AI as the marketing word of the year in 2017.
Because, I see. So you put AI in front of something, and you could probably get lots of investment in that.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. I talk to proponents who look at AI almost as a religion, and they say, you know, yeah, this is a problem now, this idea that IBM Watson can't understand. But you know what? Someday, in some way, we are going to figure out how to get around this. We're going to give IBM Watson context. We're going to allow it to be able to distinguish between these ambiguities. And I kind of have labeled these kind of the algorithm of the gaps. You know, it's almost like they want to do this and they think some algorithm in the future that they're going to create is going to solve this. Do you think that this problem will ever be solved, or do you think this is a problem of the problem that's always going to be here?
Well, I've talked to a lot of computer scientists, including two I respect a great deal, Roger Schank, who I mentioned before, and Douglas Hofstadter, who they were both there at the beginnings of AI, and they're trying to design algorithms, computer programs that would mimic human thinking and would be able to understand the world and have common sense and wisdom and critical thinking. And it was really, really, really hard. And they weren't making any progress. And the profession went off in a different direction, which is let's solve really narrow questions and make some money. And so things like search engines and things like that. But the limitation is, once you go off and look for patterns and correlations like search engines or spell checking or stuff like that, you can make money. But it has nothing to do with human thinking, critical thinking, common sense, wisdom, or anything like that. And it's like climbing to the top of the tree to get to a moon. And once you get to the top of the tree, then what? And I think what people are realizing in the profession is they got to go back and try and realize that vision of Doug Hofstadter and others, which is try and write computer programs that actually have common sense and wisdom and have some understanding of the world. And it's really hard. But I think until we've solved that problem, to have a kind of general intelligence where you see something and you learn a lesson from it, and then you apply it to something completely different, until we have programs that can do stuff like that, have a general intelligence. I mean, that's the holy grail right now, general intelligence, that computers are going to be limited in their usefulness. And Hofstadter, Doug, says that it's not theoretically impossible that someday computers will have human-like qualities, they'll have the common sense, the wisdom, the critical thinking. They'll be able to tell jokes. They'll be able to do stuff like that. But it's not going to happen in his lifetime or his children's lifetime or even his grandchildren's lifetime. It's just such a hard problem. And it's totally different than the kind of problems that most of the engineers at Google and elsewhere are working on. There are some people like Oren Etzioni up at Washington who's trying to figure out how to give computers common sense for things like, is it safe to walk downstairs backwards if I close my eyes? The computers can actually understand what such things mean.
And so you actually think that this is possible in the future?
It is possible, but not in our lifetimes. It's just...
I'd like your take on my sort of viewpoint. Computers can only do things which are algorithmic, yep. which are recipes, which are a set of yep. instructions. Yep. I believe that the things that we've mentioned are possibly non-algorithmic,
yep.
that there are things that people can do that are beyond the capability of algorithms. And I've heard no explanation of how you do this in a computer. Yeah. And yeah. with Alan Turing's 1939, yeah. whatever it was, invention of the computer, the computers today can't do anything better than Turing's original machine. They can do it billions and trillions of times faster. Yeah. But we're still stuck with the algorithms. And I just wonder if looking at the non-algorithmic aspects of yeah. the things that we mentioned, the understanding, the yeah. sentience, maybe the consciousness and something, maybe it isn't achievable. But I don't think we're going to do that.
Well, let me say I have a friend Ed Lehmer at UCLA who's a brilliant statistician, and he says that he agrees with you that it's absolutely impossible, that finding mathematical patterns will never resemble human thinking, human reasoning. And Hofstadter says it's possible, but it's not. You're not going to get there doing anything like we're doing today. You have to take a totally new approach to your programming to get computers to actually understand the world.
Yes, and so Niels Bohr, the quantum mechanical pioneer, said,
yep.
Forecasting is dangerous, especially if it's about the future.
So yep, exactly.
It's one of the things that I guess maybe we won't know till we get there, but I think some of the evidence is in. I want to talk to Gary about spurious correlations. Did you get a chance to look at the spurious correlations website?
Oh, it's one of my favorite websites. I've used some of their examples.
It is incredible. For those of you listening, if you Google spurious correlations, you go to a webpage that is just a hoot. And our director actually showed me this webpage. And it's just hilarious because it shows graphs that lie right on top of each other over usually a span of a decade where they have exactly the same ups and downs. One of them was U.S. spending on science, space, and technology. That was graphed right on top of suicides by hanging, strangulation, and suffocation. What a hoot. And this was over a decade, and it had an R value of 0.998, which means 99.8% accuracy.
Yep.
And another one was per capita cheese consumption. Plotted right next to the number of people who died by becoming tangled in their bed sheets. And that had a 94.7% correlation. Just yeah. incredible. But these are jokes. If you look at the site, you read it, you know that it's a joke. But in a previous podcast with Gary, we decided that computers don't have any sense of humor. And they might not know that they're jokes. So if AI discovers such correlations, will it be smart enough to realize this? So you mentioned in your book, one of the things is the Smith test for looking at such sort of correlations. Could you go over the Smith test?
Yeah, so I use a data mining algorithm, and I found that U.S. stock prices are correlated with the daily low temperature in Curtin, Australia, which is a small outpost in Western Australia.
Are you serious? That's one of these spurious correlations?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Because the temperature in Curtin, Australia has nothing to do with U.S. stock prices. And so an AI program found it. But how would an AI program know whether it's true or not, whether it makes sense or not? Is it real or coincidental? They don't know what stock is. They could look it up, and it might be cattle, or it might be some kind of soup, or it might be something else. They wouldn't know what it is. They don't know what stock market is. They don't know what stock prices are. They don't know what Curtin is, temperature, Australia. They have no way of telling whether that is like one of your correlations on spuriouscorrelations.com, or whether it's actually a meaningful correlation. And humans know. We know what stock prices are. We know what temperatures are. And we know that the temperature in Australia has nothing to do with U.S. stock prices. And so I thought up this thing I call the Smith test, which is give the computer a bunch of data, say data on 100 variables, and let it do whatever it's been programmed to do, find whatever correlations and patterns it finds, and then identify the ones that it thinks are actually meaningful that can be used to make predictions. And then give that to a bunch of human judges, and the human judges would decide whether the computer was distinguishing between coincidence and meaningful. And at the current state of the art, computers can't do that. They can't distinguish between real and fake.
They can't tell the difference between getting strangled in your bed sheets and the per capita cheese consumption of a state, even though they might be totally correlated. That's fascinating. One of the things that you mentioned was the inability of AI. I shouldn't say the inability of AI, but AI is a black box of giving answers which require scrutiny. You talked about the automatic pattern recognition for determining tanks in an aerial photograph in a battlefield.
Yeah.
And everybody got really excited because they were getting like 100% or 90% detection probability, but there was a problem associated with it. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, what it was what computers do is they don't see tanks or forests. What they see is pixels. And they look for patterns in the pixels. And if they've been told that this particular pattern is a tank, then when they see that pattern again, they'll say that's a tank. And if they've been told this particular pattern is a forest, then when they see that pattern again, they'll say it's a forest. And so they were shown pictures, I think it was 50 pictures of tanks in a forest and 50 pictures of a forest with no tanks. And like you say, they were perfect in distinguishing between the two. And then they sent the stuff off to the Pentagon to say, we got this AI program that recognizes tanks in a forest. And it turned out it was totally useless. And what had happened was when the pictures were taken with tanks in the forest, it happened to be cloudy days. And when the pictures were taken with a forest with no tanks, it happened to be clear days. And so what the AI program had picked up on was whether the pictures had clouds or not, because they didn't know they were looking for tanks and forest. They were just looking for differences in the pixels. And the most noticeable difference in the pixels was, are there clouds in the sky? And so it was a really good cloud detector, but it was useless for what its task was supposed to be. And again, it goes back to, they don't know what a tank is or a forest is. They're just looking for patterns.
Yes. You know, this is a general problem of so-called black box AI. I have a friend that's a CFO that we interviewed that he uses AI and data analytics, and some of the stuff he uses is black box. And then when he gets to the end and he gets the results, it's still his job to interpret what is going on and to see if there's anything goofy in the data that he presents. Right. I also heard, I don't know if it was in your book or I saw it elsewhere, of the differentiation between wolves and dogs. And they got a deep convolutional neural network to distinguish the difference between dogs and wolves. And then somebody pointed out, hey, all of your pictures of wolves have snow in the background.
Yep.
So this is exactly the sort of thing that you're talking about. It picked up on the snow and the presence or absence of snow, as opposed to whether it was a wolf or a dog.
Because they truly don't know what they're looking for. They're just matching pixels.
You also mentioned about face recognition and how it can be fooled. Yeah. I've heard recently that Apple is under pressure from some of its employees, or maybe it's its stockholders, to stop sharing the facial recognition software that it's developed. But you said that some of this facial recognition software can actually be relatively easily fooled.
Yep. And so it's a general problem again, is that these AI programs, the deep neural networks, what they're doing is they're just looking for patterns. And it turns out that you can change a couple pixels here and there, and the computer is totally at a loss to what it's looking at. And so you could take a stop sign and change a pixel or two, which we would not even notice, and the computer doesn't know it's a stop sign anymore. On the facial recognition one, there was these guys, I think it was Carnegie Mellon, and they showed a computer a picture of a guy and a picture of a woman, and they trained it, you know, look at this picture and call it guy, look at this picture, call it gal, and it worked perfectly. And then they put some goofy glasses on the guy, and the computer thought the guy was the gal.
Now, was it glasses with the funny eyes and the big rubber nose?
No, it was a frames, and the frames were kind of goofy. They were like blue colors and yellow colors and orange colors, and humans looking at them. We know what glasses are, and we look behind the glasses and we see the face, and we know it's still a guy. But a computer somehow inside that black box got very confused in its pixel matching. And it decided that the guy wearing glasses was actually the gal. And again, it's just a reflection of the fact that computers don't understand pictures. They don't understand the world. They look at mathematical patterns. One of the examples in my book, I do a little simple picture of a wagon. And simple wagon with wheels and a handle. And you and I would recognize it immediately. We know what it could be used for. We know it'd be dangerous to ride it downhill, et cetera, et cetera. And I showed it to a deep neural network algorithm, and it came back saying it was a business. And then I showed it to another one, and it came back and said it was a badminton racket.
Now these were trained deep neural networks, is that right?
Trained deep neural networks, and somehow the pixels they'd been trained on didn't match the wagon I'd drawn, even though it was clearly a wagon. And they ended up thinking it was a badminton racket. And then even crazier, there were these guys, I think University of Wyoming, they showed a deep neural network, horizontal black and yellow lines, and the computer came back and said it was a school bus. It didn't have wheels, didn't have windows, didn't have anything resembling a school bus, but somehow the black and yellow pixels confused it. And again, that's just a reflection of the fact that in the current state of AI, what you do is you match letters or sounds or pixels, and you find patterns there, but the computer doesn't actually know what it is that it is looking at.
That is fascinating. But humans have this same problem. You went through an example in your book where you generated data at random,
yep,
and you gave it to a quant person,
yep,
who looked at it and said, the quant person was like a computer. He,
yep,
applied his algorithms and he says, yes, I can make money on this.
Yep.
And even though it was just randomly generated, so I guess humans have this problem too, and maybe they've just transferred it into computers.
Yeah, that's how I first got interested in this thing, was stuff like randomly generate. I had my students at Yale flip coins, and we randomly generated these fake price charts, and then some technical analyst on Wall Street thought it was real, wanted to know what stock it was so he could buy it. And that's how I got interested in this idea of coincidental patterns. And it's the problem now is the computers are so good at finding coincidental patterns. And it's much worse than it used to be, because computers are so good at it, but so bad at deciding whether it's a joke or real.
And you mentioned the bigger the data, the more spurious correlations you're going to get.
Yeah, it's actually a mathematical proof of that.
Oh, really? What's it called?
It's pretty much what you said.
Oh, okay.
It's a mathematical proof that the more data you look at, the more likely it is you'll find a coincidental pattern. And of course, with big computers and big data, you can find lots, hundreds, thousands, millions of coincidental patterns.
So you need a human on the output to question the answers.
Yeah. And one of the problems is with these black boxes, you don't know what's going on inside. And so when it comes out and says, buy Apple, you don't know if it's because it looked at the temperature in Curtin, Australia, or if it looked at Apple's dividends.
Yes. You actually mentioned you had a student that came to you and said, I'm going to be a billionaire, and he was going to land a helicopter. I thought, yep, that was a great story. Could you share that?
Well, it was one of my students in my investing class, and I was making fun of technical analysis, you know, finding patterns in data like I always do. And he went off and went to work, ironically, for IBM, I think it was, and it might have been Adobe. And in his spare time, he was looking at futures contracts and finding patterns there. And he found all these patterns. And he called me up and said he was going to get rich, and he was going to fly a helicopter down from Silicon Valley down to my building I teach in, and land on the lawn outside the building, and come inside and tell my class the truth about technical analysis. And I tell the story every year when I teach my class, and then I go look outside the window. There's still no helicopter.
I had a guy named Jack Marshall. He was a professor. He called himself a financial engineer because he did all the math for derivatives and stuff like that. And he said he was approached all the time by people that says, I can beat the stock market. I've come up with a neural network, or I've come up with these quant rules to do it. And Jack said he doesn't even have to talk to the guy or look at the software. He just asks him a simple question. He says, what kind of car do you drive?
Yeah.
And that cuts through all of the garbage and says whether their technique has been reduced to practice or not. I've always remembered that. Gary, I wanted to talk to you about the Texas sharpshooter fallacies that you talk about in your book. And I found these to be fascinating. And I told you I was going to ask you this. So your Texas sharpshooters aren't very accurate. They're shooting against the wall and they have no aim at all when they shoot. So why Texas sharpshooters? Where does that come from?
I don't know the origin of it. I actually lived in Texas for 3 years, and I have a brother who lives in Texas, so it's nothing, it's not picking on Texas. What it has to do with is something called data mining, and that's this practice of getting a bunch of data, looking for correlations, and you don't find it, you try something else, you don't find it, you try something else, you don't find it, you try something else, and of course, sooner or later, you find something.
That was the fallacy number one, I believe, right?
Well, it's related to both of them. And
well, let's explain number one, how we do this.
Okay, so Texas sharpshooter fallacy number one is that I'm going to prove what a great shot I am. And so I stand outside a barn, and then I go and paint 1,000 targets on the barn. And then I fire my gun without even looking. And what do you know? I hit a target. And then I go over and I race all the other targets. And I say, look, I hit the target. And of course, it's meaningless because with so many targets, I'm bound to hit something. And so that's like an ESP research where you go out and you test 1,000 people for ESP, like trying to guess 10 coin flips in a row. And what do you know? Somebody's going to get all 10 right. And all it proves is you tested 1,000 people. It doesn't prove that there's actually anything going on there. And so Texas sharpshooter fallacy number one is just testing lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different theories, and then reporting the one that seems confirmed by the data and not telling anybody that you tested thousands of other theories.
And you made an example of this with the relationship of drinking coffee and pancreatic cancer and how this made the New England Journal of Medicine? That was the Texas sharpshooter fallacy number one, and it was just jaw-dropping, the conclusion that was made there.
Well, they went out and they tested. They were looking for, I think it was tobacco they were looking for. And they looked at tobacco. They looked at cigarettes and cigars. And they just kept looking at so many different things.
That caused pancreatic cancer.
And they finally found a correlation between coffee drinking and pancreatic cancer. And then it turned out that their data, well, first of all, they tested so many things that it wasn't believable. And it also turned out that their data were skewed. And the people they looked at were all going to the same doctors who were concerned with upset stomachs and stuff like that. And the people who had ulcers had stopped drinking coffee. And the people who had pancreatic cancer had not stopped drinking coffee. And so they found a correlation between drinking coffee and pancreatic cancer. And it wasn't the coffee caused the cancer. It was having the cancer allow them to keep drinking coffee, unlike the ulcer sufferers who'd given up
really?
Coffee. And now the current medical research is actually that coffee is good for you. The coffee reduces the chances of cancer.
I saw that. And then I thought of all of the different things that I've heard in my life in the on the media. consuming aspartame causes cancer. Right now, I don't know if that's true or not. Organic food is more healthy than GMO. I don't know. Drinking wine is good for the blood. I like that. But you have to, with your eyes open with these Texas sharpshooter fallacies, you have to look at these things with skepticism.
Yep. So they find people that have some kind of disease and they look at what they have in common. And if you look at enough things, sure enough, you'll find something they have in common. And all it proves is that you looked for something in common. And it's frustrating as a consumer, like you say. Your chocolate's bad for you. Chocolate's good for you. So I gave up chocolate for a while. Now I'm back on chocolate. Or wine's bad for you. No, wine's good for you. Butter's bad for you. well, actually, it's better than margarine. I mean, it's just so frustrating they keep changing their mind.
But the scary thing is this was published in a very prestigious journal, the New England Journal of Medicine. You mentioned in your book that the head researcher actually quit coffee, and I'm sure it probably impacted the coffee market for a while. Everybody's, but it was totally bogus because it was later showed to not be true at.
And not only that, but coffee actually seems to be good for you.
Yeah. Well, that's good because I drink a lot of coffee. So that's number one. You shoot at the barn with all the targets there and it hits one and you say, I hit a bullseye, and you publish the results and everybody gets excited about your results. So what is Texas sharpshooter fallacy number two?
Well, number two is you take the barn again and you don't paint anything on it. You just fire your gun blindly and the bullet hits the barn, hopefully. And then you go over and draw a target around the bullet hole and pretend that's what you're aiming for. And so that's like looking at the data after you have the data and finding some little coincidental thing in there and pretending that that's what you're looking for in the first place. So in ESP research, there was some of the research that was done in the early years. They were trying to match up different patterns on cards called Zener cards, and they would go through, and the sender would look at a card, and the receiver would guess what it was. They'd go through the pack, and they find nothing. But then they'd look at, well, maybe the receiver was guessing the next card, or the card two cards later, or maybe the receiver was guessing the card before, or the card two cards before. And you keep looking around, and you find, oh, look at that! The receiver was really good at guessing cards three in advance. And so that's what you report, and you pretend that's what you're looking for in the first place, when of course you weren't. You found some coincidence, and you treat it as if that was the thing you were looking
for.
The
trouble with this is as follows. Both you and I know the pressure in academia to publish.
It is
strong. Publish or perish. You cannot get tenure or pay raises without publishing. So...
Well, let me tell you a story. There was an ESP researcher in this lab, J.P. Ryan's lab, the most famous ESP researcher around. And he was concerned about these accusations that the sender and receiver were like reading each other's facial expressions and stuff like that. And so he wanted to set up an experiment where there were no facial expressions. And so he took these fertilized eggs and put them in a warmer, chicken eggs, and he put them in a warmer. And they were given warmth according to a computer's random event generator. And he claimed that the random event generator was giving warmth more than half the time because the unborn chickens were sending signals to the computer. And even the other people in the lab were kind of suspicious of that one. And so they hid in a closet. And they saw him go in and fiddle with the dials and make up numbers. And they popped out of the closet, you know, surprise.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy said, you know, I needed to get research funding. And I know there's something here, but I can't continue my work without the money. And so I just had to do this.
Oh, boy.
And that's the publisher perish pressure, is you get pressure to do things that are nuts. More recently, there's this famous Danish researcher who had all these crazy things like messy rooms make you racist, thinking about eating meat makes you violent. And it turns out he just made up his data because he said, I wanted too much too soon. And that's the publisher perish pressure that causes people to do Texas sharpshooter fallacies one and two.
Well, number two, I thought of this example, and it's especially going to be amplified with big data. You can go into big data and you can find one of these spurious correlations. For example, eating raisins causes planter's warts, for example. And so you find this correlation. Okay, eating raisins causes planter's warts. And so you don't tell anybody about it. You went over this in your book. But so what you do is you go and you write a proposal to the National Institutes of Health or some other place, and you say, you know, I got this idea that eating raisins can cause planter's warts.
Right.
And I want to look at the data and see what it says. And so you get the money in and you look, and lo and behold, you haven't told anybody, but you rediscover it. And all of a sudden you have a publication. I thought that was just chilling.
That's number two.
as far as what's going on. And you also mentioned in your book, and this was also jaw-dropping, but something I can believe, that a guy named John Ioannidis,
Oh, Ioannidis.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yep. Egg estimates that 90% of published medical research is flawed. What do you think about that? Do you think it's really up to 90%?
I think it's true, and it's a lot of it is the Texas sharpshooter fallacies that you're under enormous pressure to find something, and so you'll ransack the data, you'll torture the data, you'll look at different things, you'll find some coincidental correlation for some subset of the data, and then you publish that, and you don't tell people about all the other things you looked at before you stumbled on that coincidental correlation.
Oh my goodness.
And so it's so common. It's so common in medical research, they actually have a name for it. They call it the decline effect, which is something that's supposed to be very powerful, and the article is published, and then you go out and use it in the real world, and it's vanished.
Oh, hence the impact of it is declined because you've cross-validated, if you will.
It wasn't real in the first place. It was just a coincidental correlation.
Well, I tell you, you're pointing this out has really heightened my attention to some of these claims that come out in the clickbait media about different things. It's
oh, my God. Don't click. Don't click on the bait.
Don't click on the bait. Yeah, somebody gets paid advertising. Okay, well, Gary, thank you very much for this time. We've been talking to Gary Smith, and his new book is The AI Delusion. I recommend it highly. It's available at, like everything else in the world, on Amazon.com. And if you're into listening to books as I am, it's available on Audible. So thank you, Gary. Appreciate your time.
Sure. A lot of fun.
So till next time, this is Bob Marks with Mind Matters, and be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.